So it happened sometime after the first Easter. No one knows exactly when, but long enough for the disciples to have left Jerusalem and to have made their way back to Galilee. And it's a long trek. And it was home for them. It was where everything had started, which I think made it a very natural place to return when everything seemed to have come to an end. There were seven of them. Seven of the remaining 11. And Peter says, "I'm going fishing," and the others decide that that's a pretty good idea. Fishing is their occupation, or at least it was before Jesus showed up. Unlike those of you who fish perhaps for fun or the challenge of it, these men fished for a living. They didn't fish with lines and hooks, but with big, heavy nets that smelled of seaweed and dried fish scales, hauling them out of the boat with their calloused hands. I wonder if this story told in our reading today, which seems like a kind of coda added after John had finished his gospel in chapter 20, I wonder if it was not added for all of us who have to get on with life after Easter. Our temptation, I think, is to go back to where we were, to what we were doing before Easter. Before Easter came along and interrupted us with its power and its glory and its message of transformation. It's a temptation that we succumb to. To look at us, to see us, to look at the churches of Christendom today would be as if Easter 2 weeks ago or 2,000 years ago never happened at all, but was a fantasy or a fiction, even more incredible than all the others in the New Testament. For these men were, in some way, it was far less compelling, I think, Easter was, than even ours is, if you think about it. They had no special music. They had no oratorios, they had no sermons to explain it, and no world prepared to accept it, even for one day, as we do. All they had to show for their Easter were these strange conversations with the risen Lord that somehow they never seemed to recognize very quickly. So not getting on with things, they go fishing. And as you heard in the reading, they caught absolutely nothing. As the sky begins to change color, they hear him calling out to them across the water, "Have you any fish?" As someone suggested, Jesus is like a very good lawyer who never asks a question to which he doesn't already know the answer. And the answer, of course, is no. It could be an angry, frustrated no, or just a weary no. "Then try the other side of the boat," he says. And they do. And the water becomes dense with fish, their scales glinting in the early morning sun. And then I think it's kind of like deja vu. It's not the end, after all. Or else, as the poet says, "In the end is our beginning." "It is the Lord," says the beloved disciple, guessing the truth. And pandemonium ensues. Peter jumps into the water, leaving the others with all the hard work of hauling in the boat, and they all arrive to find breakfast waiting. I find it helpful to ask questions when I'm working with the text, and I wondered why or how it is that John recognized Jesus before anyone else did. This week, you may have heard or read of a discovery in the Canadian Arctic of what is termed the walking seal fossil. It's named Fragila darwini, which is a combination of Inuktitut for young sea mammal and a tribute to Darwin, of course. Now, this fossil is thought to be a missing link through which seals and sea lions and walruses evolved from land animals to sea creatures. And what intrigued me especially about this story was how it was discovered. Perhaps you read it, or maybe you heard Adrian Harewood interviewing the Carleton student. It seems that members of the research team were exploring the Hotham Crater on Devon Island when the all-terrain vehicle that they were riding in turned out to have a faulty fuel gauge, and they ran out of gas, totally unexpectedly. So the person who was leading, the paleontologist who was leading the dig, she was from the Canadian Museum of Nature. She trudged back to base camp to get some more fuel, and she left behind two colleagues, Elizabeth Ross, who's a student at Carleton, and another woman named, interestingly enough, Mary Dawson. She's from Pittsburgh, I think, some research institute there. At any rate, they started poking around because they had time to kill while they were waiting for the leader of the expedition to come back, and Elizabeth, the student, found a small black bone, and she showed it to Mary, and together then they started spotting other bones, and the first thing they knew, they were onto something, and they discovered so-called missing link. I read of a woman who took a course on fungi so she could learn which ones growing in the woods beside her house were poisonous and which ones were edible. And she said, I began to see fungi everywhere I looked. There were boletus at my front door, lichen on the quartered rounds in the wood pile, bracket fungi growing on almost every tree. Because my amateur eye had been trained, I began to see the fungi life in the world all around me. I think that fossil hunting and mushroom hunting demand an intimate knowledge of the subject, a love for the search, and an extraordinary attentiveness. And I think it's not too different when we hunt for God. I think that's why I could not recognize a fossilized bone of the Puigila darwini, and I'm not sure that I could ever tell whether something was a mushroom or a toadstool. But I'm really interested in how we make God sightings. How do we discover where God may be at work in our lives and at work in the world that we believe he so loves? I think our text provides a clue. You see, it was the disciple whom Jesus loved who identified him so quickly. It was John who linked the figure they could barely see in the morning mist with their abrupt change in fortunes, with the catch of fish. And I suggest that this points to intimacy and the priority of love as the basis of spiritual insight. In his last conversation with his disciples on the eve of his death, Jesus said this, "Whoever has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I too will love him and show myself to him." John loved Jesus. He trusted him when he promised not to leave them as orphans. He wasn't sure how it would work. Hard as it was, he stood by the cross and he watched him die. And he was the first to believe when he saw the discarded grave clothes and the first to recognize him on the beach that morning. I think that when we have a relationship with God through Christ, we learn to see him, to recognize God's voice in our lives, in answered prayer, in a sudden change in the way your life looks to you. One moment it looks hopeless, and in the next you see possibilities that you never saw before. One moment the net is empty, and the next it does not. I've had lots of interesting experiences lately. There have been lots of people who are coming to the end of life here at Parkdale. I was going to share a story with you, but then I thought better of it, and I decided to read one that's from one of my favorite preachers. Her name is Fleming Rutledge. She's an Episcopalian priest in the United States, and Anthony and I have heard her preach at the preaching conference that's coming up soon in Atlanta this year. And she tells this story. She says, this is a story about two modern disciples of Jesus. They are my father, who was about 86 at the time, and his older sister, Mary Virginia, who was about 92. She had been totally bedridden in a nursing home for 7 years following a stroke. My father visited her often, but the visits were very difficult for him and usually depressed him deeply. Mary V, as he called her, spoke very, very little during these years, almost never at all. One day, however, she said something. My father came straight home and he wrote it down, and I still have the paper that he wrote on, and this is what it says. Mary V said today, am I going to die soon? I told her I could see no sign of it, that such things were for her and me in the hands of the Lord, and I trusted him. She thought a minute and she said, yes, I love the Lord. And after a minute, she said, do you love the Lord? I said, yes, I certainly did. And she closed with a suspicion of a tremble in her voice. I thought you did. Now imagine yourself passing by the door at that nursing home, Brights Fleming Rutledge, at that moment and looking in. Nothing seems to be happening. It's just a little scene of two extremely old people in a plain, humble room. My father wrote at the bottom of the paper, end of the episode. But she says it was not the end, because that moment gave life to my father, and it has given life to my husband and our children and to me. For those who love the Lord, the end is the beginning. What some would call luck or coincidence or even serendipity, the believer calls grace. The faithfulness of a down-to-earth God who came down, as John keeps saying in his gospel, to meet us where we are in our daily routines. So when we hunt for fossils or mushrooms or God, we begin to find what we seek and to recognize the signs of God's presence everywhere and the gifts of his grace. It is the Lord. That's what the beloved disciple said. And how did he know? And how does any of us know? By staying on the lookout, by watching the shore and the sky and each other's faces, by listening real hard, by living in great expectation, and by refusing to believe that our nets will stay empty or that our long dark nights will last forever. For those with ears to hear, there is a voice that can turn all our dead ends into new beginnings. Come, the voice says, and have breakfast. When I was thinking about this sermon earlier in the week and choosing a title, as I've told you, is often a challenge for me. It has to be printed in the bulletin, and sometimes things evolve, and sometimes I have to change it when I get up here and tell you that. When I chose the title, Recognizing Jesus, it had the very straightforward meaning of knowing who he was when he showed up, as I think I've been talking about thus far. But the more I thought about that phrase, recognizing Jesus, I realized that recognizing also has another kind of meaning. It means to honor someone. It means to applaud them. It means to endorse them. And I want us to think about that meaning of recognizing Jesus. Recognizing him by telling his story, by being the story. Like all the New Testament stories, this story in our reading today is not just about Jesus, you see. It's also about us as well. Jesus is lifted up to draw us to himself, as one of our Lenten texts said, to enable us to be for the world what he was for the world. He who believes in me, he said in the same gospel, out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water. That means nothing less than refreshment and new life come, not just from Jesus, but from all who believe in him, all who follow him and become channels through which God's healing love can flow to the world. Therefore, as our text from last Sunday in John 20 said, "As the Father has sent me, even so I send you." I said at the outset today that perhaps the 21st chapter of John was added as a kind of coda for us who have to get on with life after Easter. Then surely the interchange between Jesus and Peter is there for all of us who think that you and I couldn't possibly be up to the challenge that Jesus puts to us. All the Gospels tell the story of how Peter denied ever knowing Jesus and swearing to that effect. I remember my New Testament professor saying, if you didn't believe anything else in the Gospels, you'd have to believe that story was true. Since the early church saw Peter as the leader of the church and the Roman Catholic Church insists that he is the first pope, why on earth would those who recorded the early days of the church tell a story so damning about their leader? So we can imagine that even as Peter is full of joy at the news of the resurrection, it must have been mingled with considerable dread. How could he possibly overcome the shame? How could he look Jesus in the eye? I think that that morning he might well have had trouble swallowing his bread and his fish. When Jesus turned to Peter, he used his old name when he called him, the big fisherman from his nets about 3 years before, and he said, "Simon, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And you heard it. He repeated it 3 times, countering the threefold denial that Peter had made. So Peter confronts his first call, his response, and his failure. And in the forgiveness he receives, he finds new life. And so it was with all of them at breakfast that day. Jesus met them where he met them before, in Galilee, by the seashore, the disciples with their memories of terror and betrayal and shame. They come back to their beginnings, and Christ comes to repair their devastation and to give them a new start. Surely this story is there for all of us. This story shows us there is nothing that we have done. There is no shame so deep, no failure so profound as to put us beyond the transforming power of the risen Lord. There is nothing that can put us beyond the bounds of God's love. I would suggest to you that there is no evidence that God is here today in our world, in our lives, as strong as that of lives being transformed, of a community where forgiveness is offered and received, where love is shared and then flows outward to heal the world. By believing against all odds, by loving against all odds, that is how we are to let Jesus show in the world and to transform the world, writes Frederick Buechner. By believing against all odds, by loving against all odds, that is how we are to let Jesus show. May our lives as a Christian community at Parkdale United Church assist everyone who meets us, who sees us in the community and in our own lives. May it mean that they recognize Jesus in both senses of the word. Amen.